Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. And today I'm joined by our news editor, Jordan Farley.
Hello.
And our reviews editor, Matthew Leyland.
Hello.
Hello. And Jordan is wearing a very fetching Christmas dressing gown for this. Very festive. He's very lifting the spirits for all of us, isn't he, Matthew? Because yeah. I'm not wearing anything festive.
No. I've got a Marvel top on.
Yeah, I feel like we should have got tinsel out and everything, because this week we're going to talk about 2020 and everything that happened, and it's the end of the year.
Thank God.
I know, right? So this week we're talking about 2020. It's coming to an end, and it's time to look back and discuss the movies that flew, those that fell, and the WTF moments that stood out in a WTF year. So we're going to pour ourselves a drink and put the movie worlds to right. Shall we kick off with what made our top 10 of 2020? So at number 10, we had The Assistant. At 9, St. Maud. At 8, The Invisible Man. At 7, Portrait of a Lady on Fire. And at number 6, The Lighthouse. So that's a pretty strong 10 to 6. What's your favourite out of those? You know, like, what's standing out for you guys in that?
Well, in fact, The Lighthouse was my number one film of the year, personally. Yes. So, I mean, it's a testament to how strong this list is going to be that that's number 6, but I absolutely love all the films on this list. St. Maud, Portrait of a Lady on Fire, I thought were both absolutely incredible. The Invisible Man really took me by surprise. I don't think anyone was expecting that to be quite as strong as it was, quite so relevant, such an inspired sort of update on a classic monster. And The Assistant is probably the first great Me Too film. I think I'm probably fair in saying. Yeah, a really, really strong start to this list.
Yeah. And let's not forget St. Maud as well, Rose Glass's debut in there that was electrifying and took audiences by complete surprise as well, and actually has managed to find an audience in the midst of being released during lockdown, which is not ideal when you finally got your first film out. What about you, Matthew? What's your favourite on this 10 to 6 list?
I'm going to go for The Assistant. I love The Assistant. Yeah, like Jordan says, what the first great Me Too movie. I liked Bombshell a lot as well, but I thought this kind of nailed it. This was just a bit more pointed, a bit more subtle as well, a bit more nuanced. Julia Garner, such an understated performance. You just feel so much sympathy for her as well. This drudge in this office, putting up with all these men just day in, day out. In some ways, it's quite a bleak, depressing film, but in other ways, it's so eye-opening and such a promising film as well from Kitty Green.
Yeah, definitely.
I'm a big fan.
And I think it's also a testament to The Lighthouse and Portrait of a Lady on Fire that they came out very early in the year and they're still high up on this list. They sort of burned brightly throughout the year to make the list. I loved Portrait of a Lady on Fire. I think it's so good. And, you know, there's other films that have come out this year that have sort of done quite similar things. But I think this was the one to beat. Really beautiful, really romantic, and just very refreshing to watch. Okay, so we know what our 10 to 6 is. Shall we get into the top 5 in more detail? But before we do that, shall we just veer off into TV for a moment? Because, like, there's been a show that's come to an end recently. You know, some things happened in it. Shall we talk about this?
Show me the one whose safety deemed such destruction. Must reunite it with its own kind.
Where?
This you must determine. The songs of eons past tell of battles between Mandalore the Great and an order of sorcerers called Jedi.
You expect me to search the galaxy and deliver this creature to a race of enemy sorcerers?
This is the way.
I guess we should say we're going to go into full spoilers for the final chapter of The Mandalorian Season 2. Mm-hmm. So if you haven't seen it yet, or you've somehow not been spoiled by the endless social media posts, then skip ahead a few minutes.
Yep.
Close your ears.
Have a little look at our index of where the next part starts and move ahead. But for now, let's talk about The Mandalorian. What happened in it? Groundbreaking. Opens up entire new lines of story, narrative arcs, worlds, everything. What?
Even bigger than that. Luke Skywalker showed up.
I
we just
know,
got
right?
to start there, right? We've just got to start there. Ridiculously exciting. Yeah.
Digitally de-aged Luke.
Correct. Yeah. That was sort of the most exciting thing for me, like seeing, you know, Return of the Jedi era Luke taking down these dark troopers, like with so little effort, basically walking through them. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I love that scene.
I love this whole introduction in that episode. Just the way he turns up in this lone X-Wing, and you're like, oh, are they doing this? They can't be doing this.
Who's it going to be?
And then you see little bits. You see the cloak. You see the green lightsaber as a bit of a giveaway. You see the gloved hand. Glove. And then you're like, oh my God, I can't believe they're doing this. But then I almost still didn't want to believe it until you saw his face. And I was like, oh my God, they've done it.
And the voice as well.
The actual
Mark Hamill voice.
That's right, yeah. Because Jon Favreau said since that Mark Hamill was on set filming that, so presumably they had a physical double for the action scenes, you know, the lightsaber scenes walking through, but I'm presuming that was Mark Hamill just stood there in that doorway talking.
Yeah, it must have been.
Doesn't this mess with timelines a go-go now? Because we're like, wait, where are we now with this then?
Kind of adds a few extra layers. I mean, that's the whole thing with Star Wars at the moment, is going back and filling in all these tiny gaps. The sort of post-Disney thing is to go through the franchise and fill in every little gap everywhere. And also they want to bring back these classic characters, the same as they have with Boba Fett as well. Kind of just adds a bit more to his story. Because after all, we do have that huge gap between Return of the Jedi and The Force Awakens, where we don't know exactly what happened to him. So there's quite a lot of story to fill in there. Mm. I think maybe fans felt maybe slightly cheated by the sequel trilogy, in that he's only really in one film out of the three. Mm. So this could be an opportunity to see a bit more of him and to see him in his prime as well, because we've never really seen that before.
The one thing we do know about Luke between Return of the Jedi and The Force Awakens is that he sets up this Jedi Academy to train the next generation of Jedi, you know, Kylo Ren included, and all the Knights of Ren. So it makes complete sense to me that he would be the one to turn up to train Grogu, because this is pretty much his stated mission after Return of the Jedi, that he's going to, you know, bring the Jedi Order back.
But where is Grogu in the new era? What happens to him? Does he become a Jedi? Or does something terrible happen to him? Doesn't bear thinking about. He must be still alive somewhere.
100%. Yeah. He can take care of himself. He'll be fine. What did you think of the CGI Luke de-aging?
I liked it better, weirdly, the second time I watched it. It's kind of first time, I guess you could see, you know, that it's not the real thing. But the second time, I thought, that's pretty good. It's better than Leia in Rogue One. And I think Tarkin in Rogue One is still the benchmark for CGI Star Wars characters. But yeah, I thought it was pretty good. I mean, I guess it won't age too well. You know, we'll come back to it in a year's time and it might look a bit glitchy. But, you know, it's worth it just to have him in it.
I think you can overlook that, can't you? Just for the pleasure and the thrill of seeing him there.
Yeah, and it's the right voice as well, so that's what counts. Exactly.
So obviously this has been a year that we've had plenty of Disney goodness. This is the year that we're basically being told we're getting all of our heart's desire in the Star Wars universe. Disney are going to fill in every single little hole that you might have thought about or wondered about. Is it too much of a good thing?
No.
No?
No. We had to wait 3 years for Return of the Jedi to come to VHS in the 80s.
Yeah.
4 years for The Empire Strikes Back. So I'm going to take what I can get.
Yeah.
So if they want to keep churning out these series, miniseries, films, whatever, I'm all for it.
That's the thing we haven't spoken about yet. Not only did Luke Skywalker show up in the last episode of The Mandalorian Season 2, but we also got an announcement for a new show that they didn't announce.
I know, because they didn't announce enough the first time.
Yeah,
exactly. Which is The Book of Boba Fett, which is incredibly exciting, because if you listen to our podcast a couple of weeks back, you'll know that I'm a big fan of what they're doing with Boba Fett in this show. So I'm very happy to see more of Boba Fett. Yeah.
So obviously it's not the only TV that was great this year. I mean, we've done in the current issue the best TV shows of 2020. And in there, we've got things that include We Are Who We Are, BoJack Horseman Season 6, The Boys Season 2, I Hate Susie, The Queen's Gambit, The Mandalorian is at number 2. And actually, the show that beat out Mandalorian for our number 1 spot in our vote was Small Axe, Steve McQueen's anthology. Is that in the right place?
I think so, yeah.
I mean, I know you love your Mandalorian, but come on, Small Axe was astonishing.
It was, yeah. There is a bit of a debate about whether it's TV or films. It's a TV event, wasn't it? It's screened weekly. It was on BBC. Not all the parts were feature length. either way, it's a fantastic achievement. And yeah, I mean, Lovell's Rock, that was my favourite. I thought that was absolutely fantastic. And it was so great to have that on something like that on TV to reach such a wide audience as well.
Yeah,
so,
yeah, I mean, something like that ordinarily might have been in sort of art house cinemas that people might have chosen not to go and see because there was a big Warner Brothers or a Disney film out. We all actually did sit down and watch something that was beautiful and informative and challenging and all of those other things that we talked about.
I have no idea how Steve McQueen made five banging TV movies in one year. Like, that's crazy. Like, one of those would have been impressive in a year, but five is just, it's nuts.
Yeah, so many different actors as well, so many big name actors. Yeah, such an achievement.
Right, so that's TV. We could talk, obviously, much longer about Mandalorian, but I'm not going to let you. Let's move on to our number five film of the year. And it's this.
Is this heaven?
No, it's the great before. This is where new souls get their personalities, quirks, and interests before they go to Earth.
Meet 22.
I don't want to go to Earth.
Stop fighting this.
I don't want to.
Hey, look, I already know everything about Earth, and I don't want anything to do with it.
You're missing out on the joys of life, like pizza. I can't smell. We can't taste either.
All that stuff is in your body.
No smell, no taste.
Or touch. See?
Okay, I get it.
So that's Soul, which is coming out on Christmas Day on Disney Plus. So it's just squeaking in here, but it's made our number five. Why?
Well, because for me, it's Pixar's best film in many, many years, maybe since, at least since Inside Out, maybe since the heyday of Pixar. I thought this was completely wonderful. Obviously, it shares kind of a lot in common with Inside Out. It's this sort of metaphysical jazz journey about a soul trying to return to Earth. But the thing that was so wonderful about it for me was just how earthly and grounded and compassionate and beautiful the whole thing was. I won't go into spoilers just because people may not have seen it yet, but it has like a deeper message going on in it. It's not just antics and frolicking around. I thought it was a really affecting and compassionate message at the heart of it, which moved me to tears. I'm not
sure. It did move me to tears as well, I have to say. It was one particular bit.
I thought it was a really beautiful depiction of New York in the autumn as well, just really evocative of wandering around the streets of New York, with the auburn autumnal leaves. And it just made me want to hop on a plane and go to another city, which sadly I can't right now.
Yeah. It's certainly not a kid's movie, is it?
No. In good and bad ways, really. I mean, I love the fact that they've really kind of branched out. They're doing something that feels quite grown up. It feels like a really mature step up for them. But at the same time, I sort of wonder what children will make of it. It'd be interesting to see what the reaction is when it does debut on Disney Plus, whether kids will get into it or whether it might just fly over their heads a bit, or they might find it a little bit dull because it doesn't have some of those traditional elements like action scenes or a big baddie in it. So I'll be quite intrigued to see what younger kids make of it. But I would love it if Pixar did carry on in this direction and kept making films like this that do appeal to older audiences.
I do remember people having this debate about Inside Out as well, though. And at the time, I thought it was slightly unfair. I think it's maybe a little unfair with this as well. Like, I think kids will get on with this just fine. When they head to the sort of soul world, there's a lot of fun stuff going on in there. There's like this pirate ship that's kind of sailed by this character called Moonwind, voiced by Graham Norton.
Graham Norton,
which I didn't realize until I saw the credits, and then I wanted to go back and watch it again immediately. But all of that stuff, I think, would be really entertaining. Obviously, it's really colorful and vibrant. For me, it was like very engaging in a way that I think children would like it as well, not just adults.
And all the grown-up children in us. Okay, so that is number five on our top 10 films of the year. Shall we move from the wonder and the beauty of Soul to talking about movies that are not so wonderful and beautiful? Shall we discuss the ones that aren't making the list? Let's talk Turkey. So let's talk about the films that were terrible this year. I mean, in our top 10, we have Artemis Fowl, Cats and Dogs 3, Bloodshot, Honest Thief, The Turning, The Grudge, The Last Days of American Crime, Fantasy Island, The Last Thing He Wanted, and at number one, the worst of the worst, Doolittle. Now, have we lowered our expectations in this horrible year where we'll watch anything? Is it as bad as all that? I mean, is it Cats level?
It's worse. It came out before lockdown. I think it was like one of the last big multimedia screening that went before, you know, in the innocent times. Yeah. And it was just shocking. I mean, kids didn't like it. You could tell, you know, not only were the adults bored, but the kids were just bewildered by this strange film.
It was,
it doesn't make any sense.
You know, I don't enjoy someone doing a poor accent. And Robert Downey Jr.'s accent, what was he going for?
No idea. A Welsh accent, yeah, very odd.
Very odd. And just, it felt very, very old-fashioned. Yeah. Like, not in a whimsical, nostalgic, lovely way, but just in a...
No.
People don't make films like this anymore for a reason. It doesn't work. Also in there, The Honest Thief, which is a cracker. Liam Neeson as an ancient old bank robber doing weird things in a cupcake van. Just odd. Fantasy Island and Bloodshot. Vin Diesel trying very hard to reignite another franchise, not succeeding.
No. That was kind of amusingly bad, I thought. It kind of had its moments.
And then there's Artemis Fowl, which is sort of like a try-hard Harry Potter, but just fails.
Absolutely
terrible.
This was probably the biggest disappointment on the list, right? Because it did feel like it could be something interesting, at least before it came out. But I think in the run-up to it, we hadn't seen all that much of it, and there were trailers, and there was a lot of footage and trailer was missing from the final film. And then it really stank of, like, developmental issues with that film, which is a real shame, because I know the books are much loved.
The books are much loved. It had Kenneth Branagh directing, who has proved his ability in sort of world-building films with Thor. He can do it, so I don't know what happened here. And also, Artemis is just an annoying child in this, isn't he?
Yeah, he's just not a likeable character.
Wasn't likeable at all. So those were not great. I think we should have a palate cleanser now and go to our number four. So here is our number four of the year.
Meg, it's Orson Welles.
Of course it is.
I think it's time we talked.
What is it the writer says? Tell the story you know.
Hello, everyone.
Make yourself to home, Mr. Mankiewicz, or shall I call you Herman?
Please, call me Mank.
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 This is Herman Mankiewicz, but we're to call him Mank.
So that's Mank, which is the story of Mankiewicz, the screenwriter who wrote Citizen Kane, was an absolute alcoholic and a party goer and just a bit of a good time boy who had darkness in his life as well. This is David Fincher. This is black and white. This is all period sound. It's not the most commercial film, and yet it's quite brilliant. Why?
Well, it's kind of typical Fincher. It's so meticulously made. The dialogue is so crisp. None of the shots feel out of place. It's basically a film that asks to be compared to Citizen Kane, obviously often hailed as one of the greatest films of all time. And this is, you know, such a perfectionist movie, you know, on every level, the production design, the editing, the music, and especially the acting. I mean, Gary Oldman, I mean, it's a big ensemble cast, but he's in pretty much every scene. And I can see him nailed on for another Oscar nomination next year.
But not only him, you know, there's some great performances here that probably are going to be awards bothering. Seyfried is how you say it, apparently.
Oh, is it Seyfried?
I did not know. Amanda Seyfried.
Oh, what?
Yes, I've taught you something today. Oh. Amanda Seyfried. Please say it correctly, because she will correct you if you
making
don't.
A note.
Yes. But she is very, very good in this. Who'd have thought the girl from Mamma Mia could pull off a performance like this that's so layered and knowing and wise and world-weary and all of the things that Marion Davies is, without being just the Dolly Bird in The Big Mansion, which is the character she's sort of playing.
I love Tom Burke as well, as Orson Welles.
Got the voice, hasn't he? It's
absolutely
Orson
Welles. Nailed it. Yeah.
Really
one of the best on-screen Orsons ever, I think.
Yeah.
Oh, he was exceptional.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because you could really go for it with that. You know, you could be so bombastic and over the top, but he's actually really subtle, but he does really get under his skin. I wanted more of him, to be honest.
I also love the fact that they do get the Oscars for this film, but they received the Oscars on their lawn because it was the era and they didn't go to the ceremony. But I actually like the fact that if Gary Oldman actually does win an Oscar for this, he might actually have to accept it on his lawn anyway because COVID.
The irony.
Mask on.
That was the great thing about Mank for me, because I've obviously seen and loved Citizen Kane, but there was so much of the real story behind the making of that film that I just had no no idea about. I had no idea about the political context of it all. You know, them paying to put Republicans in office at the studio, all this kind of stuff I just found fascinating. And I'm sure it's another reason why the Academy is going to love it as well, because they love stories about Hollywood.
They do.
Yeah, and that's one of the best.
I would love to see Jack Fincher, David's dad, get a nomination for his script as well, because I think if you're going to write a script about the writing of Citizen Kane, you're setting yourself up for a fall in much the same way that David Fincher himself is by making a film about Citizen Kane. And Jack Fincher totally nails it. I thought it was a really exemplary script.
Yeah, and it would be a nice thing for Fincher as well, because obviously his dad has died since he wrote that script. And so this is sort of a love letter not only to Hollywood and old Hollywood, but also to his father and his father's talents. So, yeah, Mank is our number four. So let's talk about our man and woman of the year now. We had lots of contenders, but we went for Anya Taylor-Joy and Sacha Baron Cohen. So why Anya Taylor-Joy and Sacha Baron Cohen? Why did they stand out this year?
Well, Anya Taylor-Joy, I mean, she was great in a decent film, Emma. She kind of maintained the quality, even though the projects themselves weren't always fantastic. Although I did enjoy Emma. I thought it was a very decent adaptation. But I guess the crown in glory, as it were, is the Queen Gambit, which was a huge success for Netflix and made chess really exciting and suspenseful. She's fantastic throughout that whole series. She kind of ages as well as it goes along, and you really see the aging and the maturity of her character, a multi-layered character. So, yeah, she's ended the year on a high, absolutely.
She's been cast as Furiosa in the next Mad Max film, of course.
Oh, yeah.
Although, is it really a Mad Max film if it doesn't have Mad Max in it? Who knows at this point?
He's just wandering around in the background.
Yeah.
Exactly. At this point, I can't really think of anyone better than Anya Taylor-Joy. I think she'll be phenomenal. It's obviously a shame not to see Charlize come back and reprise that role.
Yeah.
But the fact that the timelines don't match up or whatever necessitated a recasting, and I think the next best thing is definitely Anya Taylor-Joy. She's had an incredible year, and yeah, we should also say that she's got The Northman coming up, which is Robert Eggers' new film, obviously re-teaming with Eggers after The Witch, which was her breakthrough film. That's also incredibly exciting. So not only has she had a great year, a great 2020, but you know, the next few years are going to be even more exciting for her.
Yeah, well done, Anya. Sacha Baron Cohen was our man of the year. You know, he was in The Trial of the Chicago 7, which was the biopic of the Yippies who were trying to protest the Vietnam War, but also another little film, Borat 2. We're not just giving him this for being ridiculous and getting Rudy Giuliani to do something inappropriate in a hotel room. We're giving him this because both his projects really completely had resonance with the times we're living in and seemed to have a real message about doing the right thing when the world is sort of falling apart around you. I thought Borat was incredibly sort of profound, actually, on a weird level, although completely ridiculous and stupid and all of those things and gross. But actually what it was saying and what he said when I talked to him was it really does hold a mirror up to us as a society and asks us, what do we want from ourselves as a society? And it came out crucially just as the election, American election, was gearing up. And he told us actually that the Democrats were very pleased with the release of the film because it coincided with Giuliani about to drop a load of files, October files, on Biden that could have made the election go a very different way. So this is a film that actually possibly made a difference.
It changed
saved
the world.
Democracy. Yeah.
It saved the world.
Borat saved the world.
Thank you, Borat.
Yeah.
But also, he's really good in The Trial of the Chicago 7 Abbie Hoffman. And I think we sort of forget with him that he is actually a really good actor, as well as someone who has balls of steel to do the things he does in his various guises.
In some cases.
Yeah. I mean, unbelievable.
He was actually the surprise standout for me in Chicago 7, given the sort of heavyweight acting talent in that film and Aaron Sorkin's, you know, 100 mile an hour scripts. I was really surprised that he came out on top by quite a significant margin for me. Really took me by surprise, because I'm so used to seeing him just clown around, basically. To see him add this level of sincerity to a character just really was disarming and impressive in a way I wasn't expecting.
Yeah, I'd love to see him do more straight acting. Yeah, he's very charismatic.
Yeah, he is. And he steals focus when he's on screen, doesn't he? You really are interested in what he's up to. So hats off to Sacha Baron Cohen for fearlessness in acting and also just out in the wider world. Let's see what he does with Borat 3 and the rest of his choices. Okay, shall we move on and get to our number three film of the year? You may need to have a lie down after this.
You're taking my money all over town, placing bets.
I'm having very serious second thoughts.
Are you serious right now?
I know I fucked up.
Howard, where's the money right now?
Howard, got my money?
Howard!
Is it too late? I'm done. That means nothing. It meant nothing. Please. Give me another shot.
This is Uncut Gems from the Safdie Brothers. It's so stressful to watch. And it's Adam Sandler making his great comeback, which we also enjoyed. I mean, he keeps doing this, doesn't he? He does a load of dreadful films that make him loads of money that are of no merit whatsoever, and then pulls off a Punch Drunk Love or an Uncut Gems, where he is absolutely mesmerizing in a completely fascinating, horribly weird way. Jordan, just remind us, what is this about and why is it so good?
Yeah, so this is about Howard Ratner, who's a fast-talking Jewish New York City jeweler. He basically is an addict. He's a gambling addict, and he gets himself into a lot of trouble trading this rare gemstone with a basketball player. And all you really need to know is that Howard Ratner has some kind of self-destructive complex where he always makes the wrong decisions, which basically gave me a panic attack while I was watching this film.
It's so stressful.
It really is. It's a proper pressure cooker film. You're racing with him from jeweler shop to basketball court to some kind of car kidnapping situation where he's being beat down by debt collectors. And the whole film is just engineered like clockwork in a way that everything's just constantly piling on Howard. And just when you think he's found light at the end of the tunnel, he will just deliberately turn away from the light and head back into the pit. And it's just, it's unbelievable. But as a piece of filmmaking, it's an extraordinary piece of work.
Yeah, I mean, it's completely different to Mank, isn't it?
yeah.
You know, like, it's scuzzy, dirty, messy, very quick cuts. You know, the cinematography is handheld, it's jittery, the sound design is invasive and headachey. You know, nothing about this is beautiful. It literally is an uncut gem of its own. It's roughly hewn. But having said that, you've never seen anything like this before. It is its own thing, which is really refreshing.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the closest comparison is the Safdie Brothers' previous film, Good Time, with Robert Pattinson. You mentioned the sound design there. I thought the sound design was one of the most impressive things about it. Just those jewelry shop scenes where Howard's selling diamonds to his clients or opals. You've got about 20 different conversations going on around you, and the Safdie Brothers recorded each one of those conversations. So if they wanted to, they could raise or lower each of them, and you're constantly just struggling to try and hear what's even going on a lot of the time. And that just puts you even on more edge, because you're like, oh, what if I'm missing something important here?
Yeah.
It's like the entire design of this film is just made to make you feel on edge, and they pull it off so, so well. I've never seen a film that's made me feel quite as breathless and just stressed at the end of it as this, which sounds like a real negative, but is a big recommendation.
It is a huge recommendation. And also, it does have an end, which we won't spoil here, that is properly, my mouth fell open. I didn't see it coming at all.
I think that
is also great when you see a film like that.
Yeah.
Uncut Gems and St. Maud, for me, had the two best endings of the year. Obviously, I won't say what they are for anyone who's yet to see them. But
totally uncompromising, aren't they?
Yeah, they just leave you like shell-shocked at the end, just staring at the credits. That was great.
Yeah.
That's one of the big things I miss about the cinema, just being able to sit in the dark for like 10 minutes while you kind of compose yourself. Now, if you watch at home, you're just like, oh, I'm back in my living room again. Yeah. I'm not ready to re-enter the world.
Yeah, my oven chips are ready. My oven's pinging. I do need to hoover this carpet. Maybe that's just me. Those are the thoughts I'm having watching films.
One of the really interesting things about Uncut Gems is the way that the Safdie brothers use real people as well. Because there's this real basketball player in it called Kevin Garnett, because the events are unfolding against basketball matches that actually happened.
Yeah.
So if you're clued up enough on basketball, you know the outcome of these games and you know how his bets are going to turn out. But for the rest of us, it's just like any gambling addict movie where you just have no idea.
Indeed. And actually, I would say that even if you did know the outcome of those games, you probably wouldn't expect the outcome of the narrative arc. And you just find yourself shouting all the time, what are you doing? What are you doing? Because he's just keeps doing the thing that you're just like, that's such a bad idea. Stop. Don't do that. It's amazing. And what is also really quite an achievement is that this person that Adam Sandler is playing is not nice. He's not honorable. He's not a good guy. He's sleazy. He's got this slicked back hair. He's a mover and a shaker. He's always screwing somebody over. He cheats on his wife. He's not that nice to his mistress. He's really got nothing going for him. And yet you are gunning for him to actually make a right decision and for something to go well for him. And I think that's really quite an achievement as well. So if you haven't seen Uncut Gems, do so. It is a gem and it is our number three. Shall we talk then about WTF moments in movies this year? I mean, this year was practically science fiction to live through. But what was absolutely gobsmacking, good or bad, on screen this year? What did you love?
I think Keanu Reeves in Sponge on the Run, him turning up in Sagebrush.
Sagebrush.
That's pretty amazing.
Yoga.
And it's not just one scene as well. He keeps rolling through scenes over and over again. So the shock is still there every time he does it as well. The novelty does not wear off. That's going to stay with me for a while, I think.
Jordan?
Yeah, I'm going to pick The Invisible Man, which has just an exemplary jump scare in the middle of it. Avert your ears for 30 seconds if you haven't seen the film yet. But the scene in the middle of the film where Elizabeth Moss's character goes for dinner and finally tells her story, and then suddenly the knife is levitating in the middle of the restaurant, just scared me to death. I thought it was one of the most effective, just well-performed jump scares I'd seen in a horror film in a long, long time.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I'm going to say one of my best sort of gobsmacking whoa moments was the truck chase in Wonder Woman. It's everything I wanted from her. I flipping love Gal Gadot. I think she's amazing, and what she does with this role, you just love her and you want her to succeed and you want there to be good in the world like her character does. And this fight is her and Steve Trevor knowing they don't have that much sort of going in their favor, but going for it anyway, because that's the right thing to do. God love them. And in this world, I want lots of that. So I love that. But in terms of weird things, Unhinged with Russell Crowe, which was just astonishing in its B-moviness. He must have been in on the joke is all I can think, because what was he doing in it? Why was he saying those lines? Him and his courtesy tap. That's just a courtesy tap.
Man.
That was a very odd choice for him, but you know, maybe he needed a house. I don't know. The other WTF moment for me was the documentary You Cannot Kill David Arquette, which was, is this a joke? Is he for real? Is this Joaquin Phoenix doing his thing again? Or is David Arquette really this absolutely nuts as he tries to become a WWF style fighter? It's incredible. And he goes down to like homemade fight rings and gets thrown onto the floor with tacks all over. And he gets, you know, light bulbs smashed into his neck and he nearly bleeds out. And Luke Perry has to triage him and race him to hospital. This entire documentary is absolutely bananas. And it felt very apt for this year of a what's going on type of film. I loved it. Anything else caught your eye?
I'd like to add one more. The film Project Power on Netflix, which is a film I didn't mind. I thought it was pretty decent. But the whole film, you realise that people have superpowers that are based on animals, basically.
Yes.
And the entire film, you're sort of waiting to find out what Jamie Foxx, who is the main character, what his superpower is going to be, what his animal power is going to be. And his animal power is that of a pistol shrimp. Which I had not heard of. It seems like the least cool superpower of all time, but in fact, it's completely badass. They can basically punch at the speed of sound.
When I looked up the pistol shrimp's prowess, I thought the pistol shrimp should have got his own show, really, because quite the end of Sea Avenger, isn't he? He's amazing. Loved yeah. him. But yeah, I agree. That was kind of like, that's not what I was expecting. I was thinking, I don't know, the sonar of a bat or the power of a tiger. But a pistol shrimp was pistol not shrimp. What we were thinking was coming. Very good. So let's move on to our big number two in our countdown. And it's this.
Is it okay with you?
Song이는 완전 예술가 재질인데.
침팬지를 그린 거죠?
자화상이에요.
역시.
So this is Parasite, which came out seems ages ago, but it was actually this year before all that happened. Matthew, why is this so good? And it won Oscars and made history.
Well, yeah, first ever foreign language film to win Best Picture. Who would have guessed that a year ago? But yeah, it just kept going, just kept building that momentum. But yeah, this is Bong Joon-ho, perhaps best known films like The Host, the earlier Host, and Snowpiercer. This is a story about these two families, one rich, one poor, and the poor one inveigles themselves into the house of the rich people and gradually takes it over. So it's very much a commentary on the social class, social difference, but done with such a kind of amazing lightness of touch as well that it never, ever seems heavy-handed or that, you know, he's making this big statement. It's just an incredibly enjoyable thriller, really tightly plotted. Some of it, you could say, seems slightly unbelievable, but the way he puts it all together, you really do buy into it. It does feel very credible. I mean, it fits together like clockwork. It's just an absolutely terrific film that's... just keeps throwing twists and curveballs at you right to the end. I think pretty much everyone enjoyed this one.
I really loved it. Did you like it, Jordan?
Yeah, I really, really loved it. I saw this back in Cannes in the middle of 2019, and it's one of those films that still sticking with me even till now. It's a real high point in terms of talking about the things that we're going through in the world right now as well. Like a lot of films have tried to talk about, you know, economic disparity and things like that. And some of it feels a bit surface, but this felt like it really got to the heart of the matter. Apart from that, it's just such an entertaining and riotously enjoyable thriller. Like, it doesn't even need all that social commentary. It's just really, really exciting. There's a kind of montage in the middle of it, which might be one of the best sort of set pieces of the entire year. I just thought it was so well put together. Really the culmination of everything Bong Joon-ho has been doing in his career to date. I thought he was firing on all cylinders here.
And it's also emotionally resonant as well, because, you know, by the time you get to that last final sort of twist, it's incredibly sad and sort of moving as well, which I sort of didn't expect in a film that was funny and Blackleaf sort of funny all the way through it. And then by the final third is actually emotionally impressive as well. It really is an absolute cracker, but it's not our number one. Shall we find out what our number one is?
Oh, yes, definitely.
Quick recap then of where we've got to. So at 10, we had The Assistant. At 9, St. Maud. At 8, The Invisible Man. At 7, Portrait of a Lady on Fire. At 6, The Lighthouse. At 5, we had Soul. At 4, we had Mank. At 3, Uncut Gems. And at 2, Parasite. So here we are at number one. This is our film of the year.
All I have for you is a word. Tell it.
Yes, the clue is there. This is Tenet, Christopher Nolan's head-scratching, time-bending, just what order is it in spy movie that is his answer to Bond? Why did it beat out the rest, Jordan?
Oh, I mean, I'm still working out what order it was in. I don't know about the rest of you. Well, I would say it's reached the top spot of our list because for me, it felt like it was the one real cinematic spectacle this year. It was the one blockbuster that came out during the practically global lockdown. So its context is important, but also the fact it's just Christopher Nolan pretty much at the height of his powers, an incredible budget, so much imagination. It's another example of his obsession with time and ways to play with time cinematically. I've never seen anything like this on screen. I thought this was just mind-boggling in all the right ways.
it takes a couple of watches as well. Like, it, he's not going to spoon feed this stuff to you. So I think, you know, there were criticisms that it was difficult to hear some of the audio, that it was too complicated to follow, that it sent people to sleep. But I like the fact that all of those things makes it a challenge. It's not being just given to you in easy digestible pieces. You have to work for it. And I think that because of that, when you get to the end and you're like, oh, that's happening, it feels like you've really achieved something as a viewer as well. And it's really satisfying when you get to there. The sound design on this, like we talked about, the Safdies, is very sort of invasive in your ears, the classic Nolan drone going on. And some of the concepts are literally pause and Google, please. I have to just find out about the grandfather paradox and the pincer movement and whatever else we're talking about. But I've just loved the fact that it was smart and it didn't ask you to dumb down. It wasn't prepared to do that. And it accepted that audiences are capable of watching a film that isn't just oatmeal. What did you think, Matthew?
I didn't like it.
I didn't
absolutely hate it, but I was not a fan. I have to say, it left me quite cold. There's some Nolan films I absolutely love, like Memento and the Dark Knight trilogy and the Prestige, but then there's others like this and Inception and Interstellar that just kind of leave me cold. I can kind of admire all the technical know-how that goes into them, you know, and the fact that he does original ideas that aren't necessarily setting up a franchise. You know, he's kind of the only one out there doing that anymore, but yeah, it didn't really resonate with me. And I did have a problem with the sound as well. I just really struggled to hear the dialogue and I found the music quite overbearing. But luckily
for us, it's not just your opinion. We have collated all of the votes of Total Film and all of our contributors. And it was this that came out top. So bar humbug to you.
It is interesting film to have come out number one on our list because, as Matthew's just proven, it did prove quite divisive. I was surprised how divisive it proved. You know, we gave it 5 stars in the magazine. Some newspapers gave it 2 stars. And I don't agree with 2 stars, but I can sort of see where they're coming from with those criticisms. Mileage may vary very much with this film, but for me, it was just everything that I want in a kind of tentpole blockbuster. I don't think I saw anything more impressive on screen this year than crashing a real 747 into the side of a hangar.
Yeah.
Oh, now
I bet you did.
He likes that.
Now he likes it.
Yeah. Like now he likes it with the gold falling out the back of it.
That just left my jaw on the floor. Just the fact that he's doing this for real is just unbelievable. And then when you get to full like inversion craziness in the protagonist versus protagonist fight, where it's going forwards and backwards at the same time and it makes sense both ways, like, it just boggles my mind how he was even able to conceive that, let alone like physically shoot it with real people. Like, I just have no idea how you would do that.
And I pity the continuity person.
Personal
set doing that must have just been like, I don't know. I don't know if the continuity is okay. I can't tell.
No.
You can't imagine anyone fully understanding this other than Christopher Nolan while they were making this film. Do you think Kenneth Branagh understood what was going on at all at any point? Or do you think he was just
going with the flow?
Robert Pattinson has legendarily talked in numerous times about how he read the script, still didn't know, filmed the film, still didn't know, watched the film, still didn't know, but he was in it.
Maybe this is Christopher Nolan's way of making sure that spoilers don't get out, just making films so complicated that no one understands it. Can't spoil.
But also, you know, like, even if you don't like it, it's a film that is impressive because you can talk about so many aspects of it. Even if you wanted to take it apart and complain about every single thing about it, it's still provoking conversation. And isn't that what we want from films? And that's why we sort of want it to be our number one, because it is a conversation starter. It is something that you'll argue over. It people will be like, I couldn't stand it, I loved it. All of that is what we want from our entertainment. We don't just want to be meh.
Whatever you think of it, you can't fault the ambition. He always feels like he's pushing further and trying to stretch and challenge audiences, and there aren't that many people doing it on that kind of budget anymore.
And we didn't get a Bond movie, and this felt like a pretty good version of one. I mean, the stunts were pretty amazing. The action was amazing. Mm. You know, bungee jumping up a tower in India. that whole sequence with the plane that we discussed before, with the going in and holding your breath whilst trying to steal a painting, was just teeth grittingly good.
Very good suits as well. That great wouldn't suits. Look out of place in a Bond movie.
Well,
great
film.
Yeah. Glamorous locations. Yeah, I think Nolan is very upfront about the fact that he's a huge Bond fan and shamelessly pillages from that series of films. So I don't think it's unfair to say that this is the next best thing to Bond in a Bond free year.
Yeah. So that is our number one, not Matthew's, but it is Total Films number one. And if you want to read about what Christopher Nolan thought about being crowned our number one and see our full top 20 and all the other things we had to say about this year, grab a copy of the current issue of Total Film because it's in shops now. So Matthew, we know what Jordan's number one was. So what was your number one if it wasn't this?
Well, my number one didn't actually come out. I mean, this is 2020 in a nutshell.
Oh,
I saw the film. It didn't even come out. Promising Young Woman, which is due out next year, which, I really loved and kept waiting for it to come out. Saw it very early in the year, and then it went. So, but yeah, that would have been my number one. But apart from that, I loved On the Rocks, Sofia Coppola's On the Rocks. That was terrific. Yeah. Very much enjoyed that.
This was my number one. So I feel vindicated and happy. And Yabu sucks to you because it made it number one. So that is our year in review. That is 2020. Christopher Nolan reigns supreme, and we didn't like some other things. But before we go, shall we look forward to next year? A reader's question is here, perfectly timed. What movie are you most looking forward to in 2021? And please, God, let them come out. Jordan.
Oh, God, so many. I'm obviously incredibly excited about No Time to Die, not least because I keep having to write features every time it's supposed to come out. So I just need this film to come out. So
you were on set
stop.
As well.
I was on set. I was very lucky to be on set. But every time it's supposed to come out, I have to write something for the magazine about it. And I've run out of things to say at this point. So please, please just come out in May or April. So there are two films I'm really looking forward to, opposite end of the scales. The first one is a documentary called The Truffle Hunters, which I've actually seen already. So this is a little bit of a cheat, but it's not out till next year. It's about a community of truffle hunters, believe it or not, in Italy. Mostly old men and their adorable little dogs that they've trained to sniff out truffles in the hills. And I just thought it was completely wonderful, like utterly beguiling.
I told you. I knew you'd love that film.
It's lovely. It's so lovely. I just want to move there. I just want to live there and become
I want to eat
now.
A truffle with a fried egg. Somebody eats over a period of about a 4-minute section.
Yeah.
A fried egg with just truffle very slowly shaved on top with a beautiful glass of white wine. I was literally drooling. So that's a very good film for next year.
And my other one is my big stupid one, which is Fast and Furious 9,
which I'm
so desperate to see at this point. It's been almost a year since we got that first trailer, which just absolutely blew my mind on a number of levels. Finding out that Dom has a brother that we never knew about called Jacob is amazing. That Han's back. There's a scene where with a magnet plane and where a car rope swings across the sea, like, oh God.
And there's a rocket car.
Yeah, exactly. Cannot wait for this film. Like, it's the film, if it was up to me, it would be the first film that I see in cinemas when they reopen, because I just can't imagine anything being more worthy of the big screen treatment.
Matthew, what's floating your boat for 2021?
Well, I'm excited about all the Marvel films, like Eternals, because I can't really get my head around what that's going to look like yet, how different that might be from your regular MCU movie. So I'm very excited about that. And Shang-Chi as well. I'm looking forward to that because I remember the character from the comics, and Black Widow, obviously, although it does seem like it's been on the cards for a long, long time. Yeah, when we finally get to that. And then there's Boss Baby, Back in Business.
Yeah.
Long overdue.
We'll wait for that one, aren't we?
Yeah. I'll be taking my little lad to see that because he's a big fan of the first one. So can't wait to see that. Yeah, back in cinemas. Let's get cinemas back in business.
I can't wait to see Promising Young Woman. I've also had a sneak peek of it, and I think it's so good, so clever.
Yeah.
And I don't think I've ever seen Carey Mulligan like this before. And
phenomenal.
Loved it. I think it's absolutely jaw-dropping. So that one, I'm also massively a James Bond fan. I want to see Daniel Craig saying au revoir to the role in his tux and on a bike. I think it's going to be great. And of course, how could we forget The Man Who Sends Us a Cake at Christmas, Tom Cruise, Top Gun Maverick is coming out, and I cannot wait to feel the need for speed again. Can you?
Yes. Gave us one of the most entertaining moments of the year without even being in a film this year.
Just shouting at people on set.
Yeah, it's pure Tom.
Tom, who is saving the film industry one film at a time. Well done, him. So that is our 2020 roundup. Do go out and look for the mag if you're out and about. It is out there on shelves now, waiting for you with lots of great stuff in there. But for now, I think we'll just say Happy New Year for 2021 and we'll see you on the other side. Yes?
Yes.
Absolutely. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Happy New Year. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.